going to give a talk, or should we take? I've been kind of monopolizing Thursdays for a long time with my talks and stuff. And do you feel like a need for you all to ask questions and have more of a give and take for a change before I go away for a while? What would you like? Okay. The people who wanted questions answered didn't speak loudly enough. So, what's on my mind is to talk about a little bit about concentration, where we practice mindfulness, but concentration is an important part of the practice of meditation practice. I want to just talk about it briefly, but I wanted to do it first in a wider context of what's called the three trainings. When they talk Buddhism as a so-called religion, tends to focus more on practice than it does on beliefs. And so scholars who look at Buddhism say that Buddhism is interested more in orthopraxy than it is in orthodoxy. Doxy of orthodoxy means is teaching. So ortho is like right. So right teachings, orthodoxy, right doctrine. But Buddhism isn't that interested in, as some other religions might be, in right teachings. They're much more interested in right practice and orthopraxy. And because of that, Buddhists are very generous around the teachings context in which the practice occurs. You find a lot of diversity in Buddhism. And a lot of generosity about everybody having different opinions. It's okay, as long as let's just do the practice. And the practice itself is a practice of observation, of seeing really deeply. And in seeing deeply, we learn for ourselves what's actually the case. So the focus is to rely on the practice more than assuming a belief. So in focusing on practice, Buddhism then talks about, the Buddha talked about there being three trainings, three practices that he was teaching. And this in Pali is Sila, Samadhi, and Panna. And usually in English, these are translated as ethics, the training of ethics, the training of concentration, and the training of insight or wisdom. Buddhism is not such a moral system in the sense that there isn't this absolute, you know, good or bad that you have to kind of align your life with. It's rather that the precepts in Buddhism have to do with trainings. They're useful practices to help purify the mind and the heart and support the other two trainings, the training of concentration and the training of wisdom. Without some kind of moral foundation or moral fiber in your being, it's actually very difficult to develop concentration. It can be done, but it's very difficult to develop wisdom or insight. So, however, I'd like to translate these words, sila, samadhi, panna, by three different ways. Rather than ethics, concentration, and wisdom, I prefer kindness, clarity, and insight. So the three trainings are the trainings in kindness, the training in clarity, and the training in insight and seeing deeply. And I like this in particular because that means that the first training, the foundation of it all, the context for it all, the widest circle of practice, it's nice to think of these as concentric circles. And the widest circle is a circle of sila, of kindness. And then the next, once you have that, that supports the more inner circle, and the inner circle is a circle of a clarity, and that supports the innermost circle, the heart, which is the insight. And so the practice begins then with kindness. And one of my favorite definitions of meditation is by Trungpa, where he calls, he says, meditation is the continual act of befriending yourself. And this is so important, the idea of befriending ourselves, of being kind to ourselves, as a foundation for all our engagement in a spiritual life. And we can ask ourselves, whenever you reach a kind of decision-making, or have to kind of take a step forward in your spiritual life, is what I'm doing kind? Is it a kind thing to do? And if it's not kind, maybe you better take a second look at it before you go ahead. Is this a kind thing? Am I relating to myself kindly? And I know that many people don't in our culture. And because many people don't relate to themselves kindly, they don't relate to the meditation, their meditation practice very kindly either. They find the mind wanders away and they criticize themselves. You dummy, how could you have done that? Or they get lost in a fantasy for 10 minutes and, you know, they feel all the shame. Or, you know, there's all these judgments and ideas where very many people will not be kind about how they're doing. They're measuring themselves against some standard of perfection about how they're supposed to be doing. I've been told that some people, you know, look at me and sometimes see me sitting there very stable and, well, I'm not sitting still and therefore I'm not doing it right. And, you know, I'm embarrassed now, or, you know, measuring against me. And then last night I was sitting at home in the evening after our baby was asleep with my wife. The two of us were sitting. She sits more Zen style with her eyes open. So we sat and I thought it was nice sitting. And she said at the end, "Did you have a nice nap?" You know, I was like, you know, falling asleep there. So, but is it kind? Are we approaching ourselves kindly? And for many people, a lot of what the initial months or years of spiritual practices are about is finding the possibility of offering oneself some kindness, or holding oneself in kindness, to bring some kind eyes to see oneself by, and including all the ways in which we're not kind, to kind of hold it all, hold yourself with some kindness. And so the training of ethics, the traditional translation for sila, is a training in the activity, not just simply the attitude of kindness, but the actions that express kindness and friendliness to ourselves and the world around us. And so this is the foundation. And if you do nothing else in a Buddhist life, just do that. Forget about the deeper, kind of innermost circles of the training. But it starts there. And if you don't have the outer circle of kindness there in place properly, it's actually very hard to kind of come in to the inner circles. It's kind of like the wonderful door, the gate into the garden is the gate of kindness. And of course, it isn't some kind of linear path. I mean, there are times when we have some acceptance and kindness towards life and ourselves, and there are times when it's not there and we're full of hate and anger and bitterness or whatever, sadness. And then and then we kind of learn to work with that and bring our mindfulness to that. And then the kindness comes back, and then, you know, it's kind of, we oscillate around and around. Things change with times. But nice, at least in theory, the idea is kindness is the outer circle, the gate into the garden. The next circle is that of clarity, traditionally said called concentration, but developing ability to see clearly what is actually happening moment by moment. And in thinking about this, I think about the movie Wizard of Oz. You know, when they finally make it to the Emerald City, mm-hmm. they see the great wizard, and they go into his chambers where he is, you know, and he's this great, great mask on the wall, is that right? You know, he's a big billowing voice, and like he has all this, you know, he's charisma and power, and you just cower looking up at this voice, and this big godlike voice that kind of speaks down at you, and oh, you know, the great Wizard of Oz. And then at one point, Dodo pulls the curtain aside, and you see behind the curtain is the wizard with all the levers and talking into this kind of microphone or whatever. And you realize that the wizard isn't this big, you know, omnipotent, omnipotent being. It's just this little guy, balding guy, is that what he is? Kind of, you know, off there on the side behind a curtain. And this is a nice analogy, I think, for many of us in our lives. There's often something we hold as being really this great voice or great value or great idea or ideal or idealism or great thing we measure ourselves against, or there's something which often kind of is a problem in our life. It has some great authority. And because we haven't focused on where does that authority come from? Why do I believe this? Why in the world do I believe that I'm inadequate? Where did I get that idea? Why in the world do I believe that I have to make a lot of money? Why in the world do I believe, you know, you can fill in the blanks, your favorite one, the one that really kind of motivates your life. Where do you get that idea? Where is the authority for that? And part of the function of the clarity of mindfulness is to begin pulling us aside the curtain and seeing, actually, we're just this little guy in the corner. You know, and once he's found out, he's kind of embarrassed and ashamed of what he's done. So what are some of the things that we kind of are behind the curtain that we haven't looked at? Behind the curtain means things that we can, they're not unconscious, but things we haven't noticed because we've kind of kept them there to the back. And there's a whole series of things that do that. When I talk about this, I like to mention first a cute one, which happens very occasionally. And that is people can sit in meditation and get very calm occasionally and have their thoughts become very subtle and quiet and calm and almost no thoughts at all, maybe. And then they think, I'm not thinking anything right now. And they don't notice that that's a thought. And somehow the fact that they're thinking, evaluating situation, is behind the stage, kind of behind the curtain, and you're not noticing it. There's a lot of things like that that are kind of behind the curtain we don't notice. Performance anxiety is one of them in meditation, or performance evaluation. All the evaluations we make about practice, we don't think that evaluating our practice, how we're doing, is the practice. So we can do that freely in the back rooms. You know, I only got to third breath this time. Oh boy, I really blew it. I got to try better next time. And you know, we have all this, you know, or, wow, that was a wasted meditation. Or wow, this is really hot stuff today. Boy, I'm on the brink of enlightenment. And if it wasn't for the fact that the coffee is ready now, you know, brewing in the morning, you set the coffee to brew before you go meditate, right? And so, and so it's, you know, well, you know, it gets cold, right? So, well, so much for enlightenment. You know, coffee is more important. So we have these, you know, these things, these little voices behind us that evaluate and judges often how we're doing in our practice or in our life. And a part of the function of mindfulness too is open up our mindfulness so nothing is behind the curtains. Nothing is not included. Nothing is outside. None of the values, ideas, sources of authority, sources of belief, everything is included. And because everything's included, you might get some sense how powerful it is to develop kindness towards oneself. Because imagine that everything that you can include in awareness, you could also hold in a field of kindness. I think that's an astounding thing. I kind of get goosebumps kind of thinking about it. That everything that you experience as yourself and the world around you, everything you can become aware of, no matter how dark it is, can be held with kindness. Isn't that something? But if it's behind the curtain, it's kind of hard. Then you're kind of looking up at it maybe, or, you know, because you're not looking at it directly, but you see a thing on the wall. Restlessness sometimes in meditation is often behind the curtains. People don't think that, you know, people think, well, restlessness is not being calm and settled, so I'll just move and itch and scratch and, you know, adjust myself and, you know, until I get the right position or until I get it just right. But restlessness sometimes it should be included as part of it, and to develop the stability and the kindness to hold yourself still when there's restlessness in meditation. Sometimes near the end of the sitting, I'll see people more on retreats than on, you know, in sittings like this, but on retreats, I have to open my eyes because I have to look at the clock, right? Because you don't want me to go over. But sometimes I see people going like this. They're sitting there quietly, meditating, very intent, serene. You don't know what's going on inside, of course. But they look, you know, like Buddhas, right? And then like this. You know, kind of sneaking a look at their watch. You know, and that's not really meditation. That's like behind the curtains, right? They're kind of sneaking a look. And everything should be included. There's no sneaking around. You're only sneaking from yourself if you do that. And if you do want to look at your clock while you meditate, you should do it like a, you know, the Zen of checking your time. Just really, just do it. Just. You know. To hell if someone sees you.
Guilt at its own head.
if that's what you're going to do. And what's not okay is this wobbling, you know, kind of like this, you know, kind of. So developing clarity as far as just beginning to kind of be willing to open up your awareness to see more clearly the things in the corners that you haven't noticed that might have been kind of driving the show, the stage director behind the stage. But one of the things that develops clarity is the ability to become concentrated, to develop concentration. And concentration is often a little bit awkward word, because people, when they hear, "I need to get more concentrated," will often strive to do so, or will kind of contract the mind, or contract the eyes even. Sometimes people get headaches or eye aches from trying to get concentrated. There's kind of a contraction that happens when they hear, "I have to get concentrated." And concentration in this kind of meditation is not a contraction, but it's more of easing into making sustaining contact or connection with the breath or whatever you're paying attention to. I'm very fond of the fact that the etymology of the Buddhist word for concentration, which is samadhi, the root of that word, sam, means with. And the D part of samadhi means to stand or to pose. So to pose with. And that's exactly what composure means in its roots, in its etymology, to be composed. And a different way maybe of talking about concentration is to develop composure in your sitting. And I think when we develop composure, I don't think that comes with the same sense of contraction that maybe sometimes happens with concentration. So become more composed. It's kind of an old-fashioned word. Some of you might have had mothers or fathers who told you, "Hey, be composed." And then we rebelled. But it's time to. We're ready now to take on the word again, to find a more useful way to be composed on oneself, to compose oneself for one's experience. What does it mean to be composed? And one of the things that it means is in your posture. And I think it's actually quite important and very useful in meditation to take a little bit of time, even for those of you who have meditated for a long time, take a little bit of time at the beginning of a sitting to really find your good balanced composure in your posture. I remember in Zen practice, where they're very particular about good posture, meditation posture, it's interesting to watch the range of newer to older students. And the longer a person has been a Zen student, the longer they take to settle into their posture. They really take the time to kind of to find just the right balance and find just the right balance on their sitting bones and on their sacrum. The balance on the sacrum. So, you know, sacrum means like sacred, right? Doesn't it? I don't know why. Why do we have a bone called the sacred bone? Anybody know? Anyway, so it's a nice thing because our center of gravity, if you're really balanced, the center of gravity goes down and travels through the sacrum. And when we lose the center of gravity, we lose our composure, which sometimes the center of gravity goes forward or backwards. So to keep the center of gravity on the sitting bones and tailbone there is quite useful. And I find in myself that the indication that my center of gravity goes forward or backwards is a sign that I've lost my composure, and I can find my composure again by simply finding my posture again, my balance. And I notice, you know, the kind of things that causes me to lose my balance. Desire is one. If I really want something, I kind of tend to lean forward, kind of, you know, oh yeah. Or sometimes fear. I'll contract and sometimes pull back a little bit, and the center of gravity goes back. But my inner emotions affects my composure, and sometimes simply finding a more composed way of sitting can make things a lot easier, cut through some of the difficulties. But to be composed, to develop clarity, to be stable. One of the things that supports concentration is stillness of body. So not just simply taking a good posture, but actually dedicating oneself or devoting oneself to sitting still in meditation. And this can be for some people a challenge and sometimes not so appropriate, but to be devoted towards not moving, come what may. Because whenever we start moving in meditation, adjusting our posture and all that, it tends to agitate the clarity. It's like stirring up the mud in a forest pond, and it gets all agitated. But if the body sits still, you have a better chance of having the settledness. The body settles, and the mind settles with it. There's a tremendous correlation between the body and the mind. The other thing that develops concentration is a certain kind of intentness. And this is where it gets tricky, because it can take the direction of contractiveness, of striving, of trying hard. But the spirit is that of a kindness, of acceptance, of allowing. But there can be an intentness, that this is what I'm going to do. I'm now going to really settle and be in the present moment. I'm really going to stay here and notice what happens in the present moment. Like the present moment is this wonderful river, and I'm on the riverbank, and I'm just going to stay there and notice every passing wave, you know, current that goes by, whatever, that passes down the river. I'm just going to stay in the current of the present moment. Or the intent is to stay with the breathing. Okay, I'm going to really stay with the breath unless something really dramatic happens otherwise. I'm going to have this intentness with the breath, this kind, allowing, non-contracted intentness. This is what I'm going to do. I find it fascinating that we can how easy it can be to wander off into distractions. And this is kind of what we're trying to, in a sense, work with or overcome, is this tendency to be distracted from the present moment by having an intentness to, this is what I'm going to be, where I'm going to be, what I'm going to do. So some teachers actually encourage their students at the beginning of each session of meditation to actually state in their mind their intention. My intention is to try to be present now for the next half an hour. My intention is to stay with the breath the best I can, in the most kind and loving way. To state an intention, my intention is to try to be kind, no matter what comes up. Sometimes stating that intention in the beginning kind of makes it more likely to happen. Kind of sit there and take a deep breath and, you know, may I be intent on my breath. Meditation practice does take a kind of intentness. And part of the art of the practice is how that intent, how to have an intentness that is not contracted, that's not constricted, that's not counterproductive. How it can be kind and open and gentle at the same time. But I think it's very easy to lose the intentness, to kind of like let the winds of the mind, the winds of distraction, the winds of preoccupations kind of pick us up and carry us wherever it wants to go. And to have some certain kind of intentness, a kind intentness towards yourself. The other thing that can be useful is, it's not always possible, but is if you're staying with the breath, for example, the breath is a great place to develop stability, clarity, composure, concentration. Is if you can feel some pleasure or some pleasantness or some comfort in the breathing, some enjoyable sensations, not so much to hang on to them, not so much savoring them, but kind of use those pleasant sensations as kind of an anchor, as a grounding, to encourage you to stay present. Because if it's pleasant, you're more likely to want to stay present. And that's what I suggested in the middle of this last meditation. So I'm curious, how that was for some of you. Were some of you able to find something enjoyable about the breath and that help you stay present? Let's someone speak. What was your experience? How did that change your experience, your meditation? Yes?
Well, I found it a little difficult to do with that breath. Right. That's about as much as I can say. It was surprised me when you said it.
So it's still a useful instruction. And for you, it might be useful because it helps you kind of come to terms with attachment, with grasping. So you might still kind of explore that and see if you can do it. But for you, rather than becoming exercise in concentration, it becomes an exercise in mindfulness to understand your grasping. Yeah?
All I noticed was that it felt good to feel the cool air coming in. That felt good.
Was it easier to stay present feeling that?
Yeah. I think any time there's something to notice helps.
Great. Well, there's always something to notice. What you're saying is that whenever there's some kind of directed instructions, then it's easier, or?
Kind of like I'm noticing the breath, and then the dog is barking at me. I say, how many of these little things that are going on right now am I aware of all at once?
Yes.
And calling all those present. So that's my model, and it's good.
Yes.
Always find it very casual because I can concentrate on the nostrils because I have allergies. So I concentrate on the diet. It's a lovely feeling. And I, when you said that, I said, oh yeah, I've always felt that. It's like the taste of smoking, such a lovely feeling.
And is it easier to stay present then? That's one of the ways to develop concentration. One of the classic ways of developing concentration in Buddhism is to develop it on some kind of sensation which is pleasant and enjoyable. And the breath sometimes is that way. It can be pleasant and enjoyable. Now the trap here is, for mindfulness students, we all know the point of mindfulness is not to have pleasure per se, right? The point is to be present to what comes. And sometimes what you get is not pleasant. And then the stage director in the back says, you're doing it wrong because it's not pleasant enough, right? No, it doesn't work that way. Mindfulness is simply being present for what's given to you, what's actually the case. But when there is pleasantness in the breath, it's fine to use that as a way of developing more stability to help you keep the focus. And it can be very helpful. Yes?
Yeah, I hadn't realized before that it was pleasant until you mentioned that. And after you did, it made the meditation easier. It kind of brought a slight kind of inner smile to me.
That's the kindness part. Great.
Thank you.
Yes?
I felt very, very low, almost
asleep. Well, that's one of the problems also with this kind of instructions, is when we find something soothing or pleasant around the breathing, some people will then rest or hang on or, to the comfort, allow themselves to be lulled. And that's one of the traps also. The idea is how to kind of use it as a grounding, but not to kind of lean into it so far that it pulls you down and makes you dull. So keep your composure. So anyone find it difficult, the instructions, or awkward? I would expect it for some people. Yes?
Yeah, I didn't find breathing or concentrating breathing pleasurable in any way. Certainly compared to other pleasures, quite minimum. So if I were to go for pleasure, it would be for feeling myself breathing. I get more pleasure from scratching. But also, I don't understand why being in the present means basically seemingly cutting myself off from almost everything that's going on. By concentrating on one thing, if I kept my eyes open, or there's a lot more going on in the present, that would be fun to watch and interesting, and I don't know, instructive, but stimulating.
It's a good
to pay attention to and can be in the present also.
It's a perceptive concern. Mindfulness can be done in any kind of way. It can be done with eyes open, eyes closed, walking, talking, shopping, doing whatever you're doing. And that's part of the beauty of mindfulness practice. It's very portable. You can take it with you wherever you go. Just, keep doing it. But what we find is that it's very useful, pragmatically useful, to give some time in the day where we're able to do the mindfulness in a way we can bring a more careful attentiveness and give us a chance to get composed and a little bit calmer so we can look more clearly at what's going on in the present moment. Because the tendency is, if our eyes are open, you're looking around and you see someone and you see, oh, they're wearing really nice clothes, and well, I wonder where they bought those clothes, and I should get those kind of clothes, and they look kind of expensive, and I don't know if I want to afford that, and maybe I should get a better job, and You know, and so the mind kind of begins to kind of wander away from the present moment. But when the eyes are closed, then the kind of things that tend to pull, our eyes tend to pull us away very quickly into the world of thoughts and association. When the eyes are closed, it lends itself more to kind of being with something really intimately, really closely. I think most, I don't know if this is a good example, but you'll forgive me, right? This is, since you're supposed to be developing kindness. Maybe. well, this idea, you know, if sometimes when two people are kissing each other quite intimately, the more intimate the kissing is, I think the more likely are to close their eyes. Isn't that true? In this culture.
Well, they say not to trust the guy who keeps his eyes open when he's kissing.
So there's a way in which intimacy, really feeling some, really being present for something really intimately, closely, it helps to keep the eyes closed and really kind of feel your breath really closely, like you've never felt it before. Like if you, like if you're listening to great music, sometimes just sometimes closing your eyes can really help. You just want to close your eyes just to really kind of take it in, because some of the clarity that can come with mindfulness comes when the mind starts becoming concentrated. So you can really not simply just be aware of what's happening at present in a kind of global, generic sense, but really be present for something and see it really clearly and deeply in a way you've never seen it before. Like sometimes if you go on retreat, for example, sometimes, or one day sitting, or maybe sometimes here, you might leave after your meditation and you see that everything sparkles. You know, I never knew anything sparkled. That rusty bumper in that car, it's sparkling, it's like it's glittering, it's like a jewel. Everything's like jewels. It's like, wow, you feel like it's psychedelic. Mm-hmm. Wow. And because of this tremendous, because of the clarity and the calmness that the mind has, you can really see something clearly. So part of the reason we close our eyes and we focus on particular areas of the present moment to know it really well. But it's not a concentration practice only that we're doing here. So there is a kind of openness to anything, willingness to experience anything in mindfulness, but all in its good time. So we're with the breath for a while, and the dog barks, and it's really loud. It's difficult to stay with the breath. So you let go of the breath, and then you just kind of hear the dog barking and do mindfulness of listening for a while. And really, like, listen to that like you've never listened to it before, like you're listening to Bach or something, you know, just really listening. and then you have an itch. And then rather than scratching, you feel an itch, you know, you really bring your attention to that as a way you've never known it before. And then you feel some wonderful pleasure inside, so you're really there with the pleasure. So there's to really kind of try the best you can to kind of allow what's there, and then to bring careful attention to get to know it. Another way of talking about concentration in the mindfulness tradition is, in mindfulness we always start with where we're at. So you might, you know, you just simply sit down and say, what's happening right now for me? It doesn't even have to be the breath. What's happening right now? And just acknowledge whatever it's happening, it's the main thing in your experience right this moment. And that's like the outermost concentric circle. You hold that. And once you recognize that, then the idea in developing concentration is to bring three things together. To bring awareness, the experience, the physical felt sense of the experience, and your intention all together on these three, together at one point. So if you're feeling your breath, You bring your awareness to the breath. You feel the physical sensations of the expansion and contraction of the rib cage, for example, or the pressure and the release of pressure as you breathe. And you let that be there with intent, with my intention to be there. Intention, our physical experience, and our awareness come together in mindfulness. That's not so easy, because what you'll find is your intention will go off someplace else. Or, you know, your intention is to be one place, and the body brings you off into your knees because your knees begin to ache. Whichever of those three things are strongest, bring them together. If your intention goes off to listening to the dog bark, let your awareness follow. So the awareness, the intention, and your actual experience are all coming together in the same place, converging. Does this make some sense? So the outermost circle is just noticing what's happening for you in the present moment and being kind and accepting it and allowing it to be. And then bringing together the bodily experience of it in the present moment, the mind's awareness of it, and your intention to be there all together in a calm, steady way. And then when you bring them all together, then there's a beginning ability to go into that experience deeply, to really be there for it and get to know it in a deep way. And this is where concentration becomes very important. Concentration has to do with sustaining the attention on something you've chosen to pay attention to. So if you can, you kind of sustain the attention with the breath, sustain the attention with the itch, if that's what's really predominant, to see if you can get deeper into it, get to know it in a way you've never known an itch before. And it's phenomenal what you'll discover. The levels of the mind, the levels of awareness, the levels of reality, which open up when you kind of open up, go into yourself really deeply, when the normal distractions of the mind, the normal preoccupations, the normal kind of busyness and judgments and ideas, which are all kind of, we take them to be so important and so consequential and so meaningful. Unless you know. From a certain perspective, yes. But part of meditation is to learn actually a completely different perspective of life. And it's kind of like, I guess I say this often enough, but it's kind of like meditation is just helping you go to the next stage of maturation. This next stage of maturation, becoming a little more mature person than you are. And the example being, some of the things that you were totally preoccupied by about when you were a teenager, you're pretty glad you're not preoccupied by those anymore, are you? I mean, they were so consequential, so meaningful, you know. When I was 12 or something, and I went to my first junior high school dance, and the end of the dance, you know, instead of waiting out on the curb with his car to get to drive me home, my father actually came into the gym. Can you believe it? I was mortified. Boy, oh boy, what a disaster. So I don't have those kind of preoccupations anymore. You know, by the time I was 20, it wasn't so important. But then there was a whole other level of things that were important, you know, and it had to happen. This particular thing was so important. And my whole, you know, happiness and unhappiness was contingent upon this, you know. My mother, maybe I shouldn't say this, but anyway, don't tell her that I said this. She's now about 60, she's 65, and it's beginning to dawn on her, and she says, you know, I'm wondering, do I really need men anymore? Do I really need these men I keep bringing into my life? I think she's beginning to, you know, getting a new perspective on what she needs and getting freer as a result. And yet some of us are so preoccupied, relationships are so important. So there's room for new perspectives. And one of the ways of developing new perspectives is through the power of mindfulness. And one of the ways this works is just the kindness, just to keep coming back with kindness to yourself. And that's a new perspective for many people. It's a radical perspective. But then another perspective is actually to develop the mindfulness and develop real intimacy, real penetrating concentration. Really stay with the breath, to get really present for it and really still with it, to really stay what's going on, in order to kind of discover a whole different relationship to life that's different than when our main preoccupation is through our thoughts and our ideas, which is how most people see their life all the time. And you see, wait a minute, those are just thoughts. And maybe they're not as consequential as I thought. Maybe it wasn't so important as I thought. Because our fundamental sense of well-being, our fundamental self-worth, is not dependent on how anything goes outside of ourselves, the world, direction the world takes and doesn't take, and the ups and downs, and what people do to us. And it's possible to discover, with enough kindness or with enough concentration, a core seed inside of each of us that is fundamentally good, fundamentally at peace, fundamentally well, that doesn't need relationships, doesn't need anything, really. And to discover that, to touch into that, helps to begin shifting the perspective about what's really important and what's really, you know. And as part of the function of meditation is to find that fundamental peace. And then, you know, well, maybe getting my first $1 million before I was 40 was not so important after all. Which is, before I'm 30, that's what they say in Silicon Valley, right? But most of you are above 30, so, you know, too bad. Good thing for you, there's more important things to do with life. Right? I hope you know that. So that was a little plug for concentration. It's not that important, but it's a very useful friend for people who do mindfulness practice, and I wanted to give a little plug for it today, and maybe you'll kind of bring it along gently as your friend and help you in your meditation. Anything important to say before you?
On that note, do you suggest people say, you know, weave it into, you know, start sitting with concentration and then blend into mindfulness?
Some people do that. Some people will only do a concentration practice the first, you know, if they sit for half an hour, first 15 minutes, and just focus on the breath, no matter what else happens, just focus on the breath. But there's another way, and the other way is to simply be more open the way mindfulness is. Stay with the breath for however long that's predominant. And then if something else becomes predominant, let that be the meditation. But as a new thing becomes the meditation, let that be the place you develop concentration, as long as that's the predominant thing.
What is the difference between that and mindfulness?
The two go together. The mind is capable of different functions at the same time. So you're developing both mindfulness and concentration. What you're doing, the concentration is sustaining the mindfulness through time and not letting the mind wander off into other thoughts and concerns. But if you're going to be there with that, if your knee aches, and that's the main thing that's happening now, okay, you're going to put your attention there and just stay there in that knee. And the concentration is the sustaining and staying there with composure, with the awareness. That's the concentration. And being mindful of what's going on there. And not letting the mind wander off into, you know, what am I going to have for dinner tonight or whatever. Does that make sense? Yes?
You said that there were times when it was good to change your balance, to find a better physical balance and your posture. But then soon after that, you said that at times it's good, you know, to not move, to, you know, just to sit still for the whole sitting. So is there some sort of rule of thumb about?
The middle ground. It's best when you first sit down to give some care to your posture, to really make sure you're sitting in a balanced way. And then my rule is, you know, maybe if a couple of times in the course of a 45-minute sitting or something, you adjust your posture, that's fine. But if it starts being more than two or three times, then it's not so useful. And then actually it's probably more useful to bring mindfulness to the slumping, to bring mindfulness to what it feels like to be leaning forward. And actually to discover more intimately what's actually happening rather than overlooking it by straightening out. But if it's a couple of times, it's okay. And if it's subtle, you know, just subtle, little subtle movement, you know. But if it's, you know, if it's a lot. And you'll notice yourself the effect it has on your mind if, you know, if you're suddenly kind of, oh. You know, a little bit hard to settle down. Well. So let's sit a teeny bit before the end. So start to see if you can begin with kindness. Can you hold yourself in a kind embrace of awareness? What inside of you needs your kindness? Is there any preoccupation behind the curtain? And then settle yourself, compose yourself on your breathing. Seeing if you can sustain the attention on the breath through time without force, but without, but with intent. Thank you all. And since we do have two guests coming the next couple of weeks, I just want to remind you that we do have a donation basket out there for the teachers. And, so those of you who are inspired to offer support, and, there's two baskets out there actually, one for the teachers and then one for the rent. And we need to pay for the rent for the room, and I recommend $1 per person would be great if you help pay for the rent. And then whatever you want to do for the teachers is always gratefully received. So may you all be happy and kind and concentrated and have a nice week.